I think it's important to recognize that things like success are not, you know, a pie that gets carved up. And so if you get a big slice, it means I get a small slice. You know, it's much more fluid than that.
Hi, I'm Christine Shaw, CEO and President of Naylor Association Solutions, and I'm your host of the Association Advisor Podcast. We'll learn from successful association executives, partners, and clients on how to create a thriving, prosperous, and value-driven association. I invite you to join me in keeping informed and, most importantly, keeping your association profitable. Our goal is to leave you feeling inspired, more confident, and more knowledgeable. This is the Association Advisor Podcast.
Hi, and welcome back to the Association Advisor Podcast, brought to you by Naylor Association Solutions. I'm your host, Christine Shaw, and today's guest is Meredith Martino, the Executive Director of the nonprofit Women in Government. In her previous role, Meredith worked for nearly two decades at the Association of Port Authorities, most recently as its Vice President of Membership and Sponsorship. At Women in Government, Meredith leads a nonpartisan organization that empowers women state legislators through conferences, networking events, and educational opportunities. So it's especially appropriate that today's episode is during an election season with a female presidential candidate. We'll be speaking with Meredith about her philosophy on collaborative leadership and strategic organizational planning. She'll also share how she oversaw an award-winning brand transformation and what she learned along the way. Meredith has a lot of meaningful experience that we can all learn from, so let's get started. Meredith, welcome to the Association Advisor Podcast. I am so thrilled to have you as our guest today.
Thank you, Christine. I am delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're so welcome. Well, let's get started by telling our listeners a little bit more about you. Your career actually began as a staffer in the U.S. Senate. Amazing. But I'd love to hear how you made your way from there to your current role leading women in government.
Yeah, my very first job out of college when I was in graduate school was working as a staff assistant in the Senate for then Senator John Glenn from Ohio for his committee staff. Or as my then 12-year-old brother put it at Thanksgiving that year, you answer phones for an astronaut. And that was pretty much true. That was exactly how I started my career. And from there, I went after he retired. I worked for another senator from South Dakota, kind of built up a little more policy chops. And then I decided that I really liked policy, but I didn't necessarily have the patience for Capitol Hill. So I moved over to lobby for a trade association and spent a few years there, and then moved to the American Association of Port Authorities, where I spent the bulk of my career so far, 17 years there so far. I lobbied for about 8 years with AAPA, and then I kind of returned to my communication roots with my journalism degree and became a member of the communications staff there, and then ultimately joined the executive team as Vice President of Membership and Sponsorship, overseeing revenue streams and events, and all of that culminated in my being selected to serve as Executive Director of Women in Government, where I kind of get to take all the different pieces of my previous positions and use them in one job, which is really fun.
You know, all I can say is, wow, that's quite a breadth of experience. And I love how that's all come together in serving you in your role now. And let's talk a little bit about some of the crossover that you've seen with the association, your nonprofit work, especially when you tie it into where you are today. I'd love to learn more about that.
Yeah, it was interesting making the switch from 20 years of association work to a nonprofit. Obviously, the biggest difference is the revenue model, right? We don't have dues. That's the biggest thing is that we don't have dues. The other thing that's really interesting is that our conferences don't make us money. In fact, they usually cost us money because we're spending money to help get women legislators to come and participate. So that's a really different mindset than the association world, where conferences and events are often a significant source of non-dues revenue. And so just having to kind of adjust my thinking a little bit about like what the purpose of a conference is for our organization versus a traditional trade association or professional society. But there are definitely similarities as well. When you look at the non-dues revenue portion of a trade association, it looks very similar to the way that we raise almost 100% of our money, which is through sponsorships. And so we have a structure for sponsorships, very similar to organizations that have annual, you know, memberships or annual sponsorships, you know, where a company or an organization can get a year's worth of varying benefits for one price. But then, you know, similar to trade associations as well, we also have a la carte sponsorships and opportunities for companies to come in and just do a single project with us, or just have a presence at one of our conferences, maybe because it relates to their business unit or they have a significant presence in that state. And so they want to be represented there. So there's definitely similarities and differences in the revenue side. The other thing that I would say is pretty similar is it does kind of relate to the non-dues revenue, is that even though our women legislators aren't members in the sense that they don't have to sign up or pay any kind of a fee to belong to the organization, they are the primary constituent. And the other organizations and companies that participate with us that provide almost 100% of our funding are people that are interested in influencing state policy, companies that are interested in influencing state policy. And that's very similar, I think, to a trade association or professional society, where there's often kind of the core membership of the group of people, the industry or the career path that the organization is serving. And then there are the companies that provide goods and services, right, to that industry or that career path. And so, you know, they're often interested in supporting the trade association or professional society because there's overlapping professional goals. So there's definitely some similarities, but there are differences as well. And I enjoy that. It's definitely been a learning experience for me and kind of, you know, kept me on my toes.
Well, and what's great to hear, though, is the transferable skills that you can bring. And I think that's encouraging for women in general, especially if you're in a current role and you want to expand your skills or your leadership, knowing that those are transferable from the two worlds you operate in is really encouraging. So thanks for sharing that and how those have helped and benefited you. Let's talk a little bit about your current role. I understand under your leadership at Women in Government, you've gone through a very successful brand transformation and website redesign. Tell us a little bit about what that process was like, and of course, any lessons you may have learned along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, when I joined the organization a little over 3 years ago, the logo and branding, if you can even use the word branding, was just not strong. The logo was something that was very similar to other logos in the state government affairs space. If you start looking around at this industry at all, you'll see a lot of domes, and you'll see a lot of stars, and you'll see a lot of red, white, and blue. And we had all three of those things in our logo. And so it wasn't something that necessarily stood out, you know, when people were looking at all the different groups that work in the state government affairs space. The website was also very old, not very functional, and more importantly, it didn't do a good job of showcasing who we are as an organization, really, to anyone. It didn't show it off well to legislators who might have been looking for policy ideas. It didn't show it off well to potential sponsors who might be wondering, you know, why they should, you know, support our organization and what kind of benefits they would get from it. And so we convened a task force of constituents to try and help inform the process. So we had some board members, and at Women in Government, all of our board members are current women legislators. So we're entirely legislator led. So we had a Republican and a Democrat. from the board who, you know, both very involved and invested in the organization and had a lot of history. But then to balance that perspective, we invited two relatively new women legislators to participate. They'd only engaged with us, you know, maybe once or twice. They didn't have that long history and institutional knowledge. And so, you know, they were kind of bringing some fresh perspectives, again, a Republican and a Democrat. We also involved a couple of members of our business council, which is a way that we organize our private sector support, those companies that want to support women in government for the entire year. Our members of our business council, so we invited them to participate. And then we had myself and our manager of communications participate from the staff perspective. And we partnered with a really great company that does both graphic design and website development and some other creative work in that space. And they were fantastic partners. You know, they gave us probably 20 to 25 different logo concepts, just really looking at a variety of different, you know, ideas that could potentially evoke the idea of women in government and women state legislators. And then when we kind of settled in on the torch logo, then we started looking at colors. And my goodness, there are a lot of color options. You know, even when we kind of agreed it was going to be a pink and a purple, there were a lot of options. So we ended up with a logo that most people warmly embraced. It's definitely something that stands out in the state government affairs space. Again, we left behind the domes, we left behind the stars, we left behind the red, white, and blue, but we had a really thoughtful logo. The torch is obviously meant to evoke Lady Liberty, as I like to say, the original woman in government. And if you look closely, the starburst around the torch is actually made up of W's, so it reinforces that idea. The pink is meant to be a nod to the fact that we're an organization for women, and the purple is a nod to the fact that we are bipartisan. And then from there, you know, we built out a full, you know, suite of branding materials. So we have, you know, all the secondary and tertiary colors and fonts. And then we set about redesigning our website and really thinking about user experience and the way that it comes across. And it's been really well received. I know that our creative partner has won some awards for the work because it was, you know, really dramatic and has been very successful. But one thing that I did learn that I think is important to keep in mind is that design is kind of personal, right? Like, it is really hard to get 100% of people to like the same concept, the same logo, you know, the same colors even. I'll never forget, you know, I had one board member at the time who didn't understand why we had to choose a non-standard purple. That was her language. And so it's just little things like that, you know, that it can be really hard to get unanimity on something that is as personal as design. And so I think that for anyone who's undertaking that kind of work, recognizing that 80 or 90%, you know, support or endorsement is probably as good as it's going to get. And the idea that every single person is going to love every element of a new brand is just probably not realistic. So I think it's great to have an inclusive process. I think that's just something in general that I try to do. But at the end of the day, I think you also just have to recognize that, you know, when it comes to design, you know, there's a reason people have their own personal style. They decorate their homes differently, is that design is kind of personal. And so that was something that I will keep in mind if I ever go through this process again.
Well, thank you for sharing that. First of all, congrats on the outcome. It's a stunning design and logo. You've done a great job. And, you know, Meredith, I always say to people, and because I've undergone some of these myself, is never be a focus group of one. And what you did is you just articulated a really great process that includes diverse opinions, cross-based, but acknowledging and accepting. You say personal, I use the word subjective, right? So if you put 100 people in the room, you're not going to get the same response, whether it's art, colors, decor, and branding is very similar to that. So the fact that you go through a process like that and you get the majority, I think is a really good approach. And then you can go with where the majority sits, knowing and accepting you're just not going to get 100%. But then the brand takes on its own meaning by how you use it and implement it. And it's interesting because I bet a year from now, the people who are concerned about the non-standard purple that won't even come up anymore because they'll see it in motion. It will just be part of who you are. So you've done a great job leading that process. So kudos to the team. Let's talk a little bit about the community that you serve. So the community base in women in government is very different, and it can change each election cycle as women move in and out of legislative roles. So how do you make sure that you're meeting the needs of the community and the changes that happen within those cycles?
That's a great question, and something that's always a little bit of a struggle, not an insurmountable obstacle by any means, but definitely something that requires work. It's definitely not a part of this organization or my job in particular that can ever just go on autopilot. We have a couple of different ways that at Women in Government, we try to make sure that we're keeping up with the mood, the vibes, as the kids would say, in different state houses. One, as I mentioned, we have an all legislator board of directors. And so I think that's really important. They come from, right now it's 14 different states. Next year, I think we are going to have 14 legislators from 13 states, but they are split evenly, 7 Republicans and 7 Democrats. So the group that's in charge of governance is diverse in terms of regional geography and political party, and I think that's helpful. But then beyond our board of directors, we also have opportunities for women legislators to serve as state directors. And we have space for up to 4 state directors in each state, ideally 2 Republicans, 2 Democrats, 2 upper chamber, 2 lower chamber. It's not always possible because of the political makeup of individual state legislatures. Sometimes that's easier said than done. But the goal there, again, is to have diversity in who is interacting with women in government. And also then ideally we have a touch point and a brand ambassador who can reach out to, say, the Senate Republicans in this state or the House Democrats in that state. And that's really important because while you might think that, say, all the Democrats in one state, talk, or all the Republicans in another state talk, that's not always the case. A lot of times it's very chamber specific, senators know senators and delegates or representatives know delegates and representatives. And so it's really important to have a wide variety of perspectives engaged with the organization. But I think the thing that we are most proud of that I do a lot in the spring is I go to state capitals, usually go to about 8 to 10 state capitals when legislatures are in session. And that's generally January through May in most states. Some states there's really short legislative sessions. Some of them meet year round. It's a full-time legislature and they meet year round. Some of them only meet every other year. There's a couple of states that only meet every other year. But going to the state capitals allows us to meet and engage with women who might not travel to conferences or otherwise engage with us. It's funny. I see a lot of state legislators on what I kind of call the conference circuit. There's a lot of conferences for state government affairs, and I see a lot of the same people. It's clear there are some people who like conferences, they like to travel, they have the ability, and so they go. And then there are other legislators who I don't think really are that interested in conferences, or maybe they, often legislators have other jobs. In most state legislatures, the average annual salary is, I think, $40,000 a year. And so almost, either you're retired or you have another job. And so not everyone, especially if you have another job, is able to attend either our conferences or anyone else's. And so by going into the state capitals, you can meet people that you might not otherwise meet if you're only expecting to see them at events. I think that's really important and really valuable. It also builds a lot of credibility with women state legislators about who we are and what we do, especially for state capitals that are hard to reach. I've been to Jefferson City, Missouri, for example, and, Frankfort, Kentucky. Those aren't big cities. They're not close to an airport. If you're there, you're there because you have business in the state capitol. And it means a lot to those legislators that you made the effort to come and meet them on their turf, see them where they are. And so that's always a way to kind of check in with the women legislators about, you know, kind of what's happening. And I will say, in terms of big trends, a really great source of information for us is the Center for American Women in Politics. It's run at Rutgers University. They have tremendous data. They're nonpartisan. There's no political agenda there, but they just house tremendous data about the state of women in American politics, both at the federal level and at the state level. They track how many women are in legislative leadership positions. They track state level data. I think they have territories included, and you can see the trends that are happening. And so, you know, that's something that I'm always looking to, you know, to see, you know, how many women legislators are in XYZ state, or, you know, are there, you know, a significant number of women in the upper chamber? That's, you know, a lot of times the Senate is much smaller than the lower chamber. And so you might only have 30 senators in the entire chamber. And so looking at, you know, okay, what's realistic for us in terms of, you know, what we're shooting for and with engagement. But those are some of the different ways that we try to keep up with what's happening. And then, of course, I do a lot of reading and just try to stay on top of the news.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of your community and the base of women you serve, the base of women in women in government is a group of very accomplished female leaders. And of course, you're in that group as well as a contributor and as a leader. So are there challenges that you see that are unique to women in these leadership positions or that you've experienced personally?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we're seeing it now in the presidential election, quite frankly. I think that, you know, there are so many voters who keep saying that, you know, they want to know more about Kamala Harris's positions. What are her policy positions? What are her positions? I don't know enough about her positions. I don't think those same voters are asking those questions of Donald Trump. And I would say this if it were Joe Biden and Nikki Haley running. I don't think it has anything to do with partisanship. I think that, you know, you're seeing in many cases women kind of held to a different standard than men are held to. You know, again, no one is clamoring for Donald Trump to give a big meaty policy speech so that people can understand what his policy goals are for a would-be second term. But, you know, those same people are, you know, nitpicking details, you know, about this tax proposal or that tax proposal from Kamala Harris. So I think, you know, again, I use that as an example because I do think it is indicative of the fact that women are often held to a different standard, whether it's running for president, serving in their state legislature, being a CEO or an executive of an organization. I think that sometimes women are just held to different standards. And I think, you know, that's just something that having more women in leadership is probably the solution there, that, you know, eventually it just hopefully will become a non-issue. Hopefully those different standards will go away. But the other thing that I think is a real challenge is that women, I think, can hold themselves back from leadership positions. Women like to feel very confident that they are smart enough on a particular topic, for example, to chair a committee. There was a great article recently from the Associated Press about the role of women senators in Nebraska. And Nebraska is interesting because it's the only state in the country that is a unicameral state legislature. So there's no two chambers, there's just one chamber. So the politics are very different because there's no, you know, back and forth between the House and the Senate in Nebraska. It's just one decision-making body, and whatever they decide is what's done. Their governor recently called them into special session to address property taxes. And it was the women senators who really emerged as the leaders to try and figure the issue out. And they didn't do necessarily what the governor wanted. And that was a mix of both conservative and progressive senators. It wasn't that they were necessarily breaking down on political lines versus their governor. Some of them are, you know, even though Nebraska is nonpartisan, they're, you know, there's obviously political ideology at play. So even senators that might normally be really aligned with the governor didn't necessarily like his ideas. And they ended up partnering with some women of very differing political ideology to get some things done in that special session. So hopefully, again, as we just see women leading and doing things and it becomes more normalized, you know, women will have the confidence. But the senator in charge of the Revenue Committee in Nebraska, you know, is quoted in that article as saying that she initially didn't want the job of chair because she didn't feel that she understood enough about the subject matter. Whereas I think that men are a little bit more comfortable saying like, yeah, that sounds interesting, I'll learn it as I go, or, you know, I'll get smart about doing that. And so I think that that's something that women have to be mindful of, is that you don't have to know 100% of a policy issue or a position or an industry to take a leadership role. And, you know, it's like, if you have the skills and you have the ability to learn, well, then you can learn as you go and you can grow into the role. You don't necessarily have to be fully formed to step into the role and take that position.
Yeah, I think to add to that, Meredith, there's two pieces from my perspective. Is one, I have seen, and it drives me crazy, that anytime you see a high-level female leader and a mistake is made, they blame it on a DEI hire instead of the fact that mistakes are gender agnostic. Just as many men have made mistakes, and that's part of a career. It's part of life. We're all going to do it, and it doesn't matter which gender you are. So that really drives me crazy. That hurts the confidence factor, right? Because men don't come under that kind of scrutiny. It's okay, there was a mistake and that gets acknowledged, but it's never because they're male. Whereas with women, if there's a mistake, it's because you somehow must have been a DE hire and it's not that you're human. And I think we need to really stop doing that and hold accountability on that. And then that gets back to the confidence thing and just giving women more confidence, because no matter what, it's very rare when a candidate goes into the role that is 100% of everything. And to your point, there's some things you have to have, but there's some things you're not going to have, but you're going to grow into it. Or, as you know, any good leader assembles a team of people who surround them that fill in the gaps. And that's what a good leadership team is all about. And it actually leads me into my next point about you. I know one of your leadership styles and traits is collaborative and empowering your team members, right? And for all leaders, regardless of your gender, that's a better way to lead. So talk a little bit about that. And I think that's also how we help women be more confident in taking leadership roles.
I've always believed that having a really competent staff just reflects well on you as a leader. I don't think there's, you know, anything wrong with, and I think there's everything right with letting your staff have the credit for doing a good job on something. And again, I think that partly, you know, that idea and the idea of collaboration comes from the fact that I'm a big believer in having an abundance mentality and not a scarcity mentality. I think it's important to recognize that things like success are not, you know, a pie that gets carved up. And so if you get a big slice, it means I get a small slice. You know, it's much more fluid than that. You know, there's enough to go around. You're not going to run out, you know? And so I think that's part of it, is just going into it with that mentality of abundance instead of seeing it as a zero-sum game and a competition. But in terms of, you know, what that collaboration looks like with me and my team, and I have a very small team. It's me and three wonderful, hardworking women that are the staff of Women in Government. But I try very hard, first of all, to be accessible and available on a regular basis. I do one-on-one meetings each week, as long as I'm not traveling, with each staff member. And that's not so that I can check up on their progress. It's so that they have a regular opportunity to check in with me about the things that they need, right? I have had, and I'm sure we've all had, bosses in the past where their inbox felt like a black hole. You'd give them an idea, you'd, you know, propose something, and you wouldn't get a no, but you wouldn't get a yes either. You just wouldn't get an answer, and you just didn't really know how that idea was received, or you know, what kind of feedback you could expect on it. And so, you know, I want my team to know that they have a chance to say, I need you to review this thing. I have this idea that I wanted to talk to you about. So it's about making sure that I'm available and accessible to them. And I always end every one-on-one meeting with the same two questions. I say, is there anything that I owe you right now? email that I haven't responded to, a document that I need to review, you know, something that, you know, you're waiting for me on, because I think sometimes people can be hesitant to press their boss, right? Like, hey, remember that email I sent? You know, can I check in on that? So I just make it really just open. Is there anything I owe you? Because, you know, things sometimes we get busy, we forget to respond to that email, or that thing isn't urgent to me, but maybe it's really urgent and important to that staff member. So I just check in. And then the other thing I always ask is there anything in your way right now of success? And that could be technology. It could be a person that they have to work with, you know, at another organization. It could be something personal, you know, where they need a little more flexibility in their work. And so I think, you know, having those one-on-one meetings and running them the way that I do engenders a lot of goodwill in the team. And the other thing that I try to do is just make sure that they have opportunities for both professional development. I pushed hard with our board this year to make sure that we had a line item in our budget for staff professional development, so that they could go to a conference, you know, that's not part of their job responsibilities, or one staff member is going to get a certificate, an online certificate from a university program early next year, where she'll, you know, take a couple of days off work, but, you know, we're paying for the experience as part of her professional development. And she would rather do that than a conference. So, you know, letting them know that the organization is investing in them, is interested in their professional development, and wants to see them succeed. And then I make sure to take them places with me. I do a ton of travel. Like I said, the state capitol visits, the other conferences that I go to, you know, looking at planning our conferences, I'm on the road a lot. And I feel comfortable being on the road, and I don't necessarily need someone to come and staff me, but I want to make sure that the staff gets to see what it's like to go to a state capitol, that they get to go to some other conferences that are relevant to our work, and, you know, they can meet women legislators at those places. And again, I think it makes the organization look great to have a deep bench, for people outside the organization to know that it is not just Meredith. You know, women in government is not just one person, that there is a team of competent, capable people here. And I'm comfortable having them go out and, you know, represent the organization, and, you know, have opportunities to engage. So those are just some of the ways that I try to, you know, live the collaboration value. But I really do think it all starts with an abundance mentality and just never being afraid of, you know, the idea that someone getting something is not taking something away or keeping something from someone else. It's like, it's a wellspring. There will be more. There will be more to share.
Yeah. Merit, thank you for sharing that. I mean, it is so important because, you know, I subscribe to that line of thinking, but you made me really think about making sure your staff understands what that means. And I loved your analogy, because we actually do have this pie chart of success, but to be able to explain it that the slice size is irrelevant, right? There's enough to go around, and maybe we should even change our diagram based on this conversation, but I've learned a lot. So this episode has gone by so fast, but you shared a lot about leadership skills, transferable skills. You've shared a lot about women in government, associations, branding. I mean, it's just chock full of information and insights. So I'm really thrilled that you were able to give us your time and your willingness to talk openly about your experience and some key takeaways. One of our most fun questions that we've asked, we've built a great list of reading recommendations, is what are you reading, or what books have you read that you recommend that our audience get and read?
I am an avid reader. I read all the time. Goodreads is like my favorite social app. I'm always tracking what I want to read and writing reviews and looking at what my friends are reading. And so I would just say read, read, read is the most important thing. And while I do read a lot of books, the other thing that I would just say is that I really believe in paying for long form journalism. I have a journalism degree. I have friends who are working journalists. And while I love the idea of citizen journalism, there is something just really important, I think, about supporting, you know, I subscribe to the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and the Washington Post. and I read a lot every day and, you know, make sure to get to the end of an article, you know, read the whole thing and not just skim the headlines. So in addition to books, I just want to put in a plug for long form journalism. But, you know, when it comes to reading, I will say I don't read a lot of books about like leadership styles or, you know, business or anything like that. I really love memoirs and, you know, people telling their own stories, especially those are great as audiobooks. And two that I think are kind of relevant to this discussion are, if you haven't listened to or read Abby Wambach's Wolf Pack, it's fantastic. It's very short. It's like 120 pages or maybe like a 2-hour listen as an audiobook. And it kind of stemmed out of a commencement address that she gave about 5 years ago. And it really is about, you know, women in leadership, collaborative leadership. You know, as someone who's been a successful team leader. So I definitely think that's a great one. The other one that I would recommend is The Power of Lift by Melinda French Gates. The Gates Foundation is doing just really incredible work worldwide, and it really shines the light on especially women globally who are in poverty and, you know, struggling with infrastructure and support, education. It really just emphasizes what communities and countries can become when they invest in all of their citizens, you know, including women. So those would be my two picks. But I feel like we could have a whole separate discussion about books.
Yeah, no, Marathon, I love that you took a different twist in gay memoirs, because there's lots of fantastic leadership books. But you're right. I mean, hearing somebody's story and reading about somebody's story gives some of the best information out there. So thanks so much. This was a fantastic episode. How can our listeners follow you and stay in touch? Are you on LinkedIn, or what are your favorite social apps?
Yep, I am on LinkedIn, and I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. So feel free to connect with me there. Womeningovernment.org is our organization's website, and we have all of our social media handles there, and we're on all the major social channels. And I will say we are also on SoundCloud, and that sometimes we work with partners to produce podcasts as well, kind of intermittently, on policy topics. And we also allow women legislators to record public service announcements on important topics. And so you can go and hear all the different women legislators who have recorded public service announcements. So not everybody has a SoundCloud account, but we have a SoundCloud account in addition to, you know, Facebook, Instagram, X, and LinkedIn.
Awesome. Wow. Very impressive. Meredith, this is a great episode. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah. Thank you for having me, Christine. This was super fun.
Thank you for listening to the Association Advisor podcast, brought to you by Naylor Association Solutions. If you'd like to access more resources to serve your association needs or join our newsletter, you can visit our website at naylor.com or just click the links in the show notes of this episode. Please be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast listening app, like Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcasts, so you won't miss an episode. Also, I'd love to hear from my listeners directly. Feel free to email me at Christine, christine.shaw@naylor.com. Until next time, we at Naylor are wishing your association success.